Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining us this week, CEO of Multichannel Network, Anthony Fitzgerald.
Morning, Tim.
And our producer, Alice Terlikovsky.
Hi, Tim.
This week,
who are the new Freeview channels taking the audience from?
Australia picks its most trusted brands and dirty grannies.
The Murdochs face the music and the cream pie.
So, Anthony, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Now, it's probably worth catching up some of the things that MCN have been up to. I guess one of the kind of sort of milestones in recent months has been Damien Keogh, who got a big new job. He went off to head up Val Morgan, the cinema advertising company. Bit of restructuring around that. How is that all bedding in?
It's relatively early, but we were able to restructure after Damien's departure with a couple of senior internal appointments, so that made the transition very, very easy for us. We were able to, over a longer period of time, train a couple of our senior executives to be ready for this move, and Mark Frayne, who was our Sydney sales director, of course, was promoted to national sales director. And Elizabeth Minogue, who's been heading up our strategic integration team, we elevated that role to a director role to report directly to me. So it was a very simple transition. We've been operating now for 3 or 4 weeks under that structure, and the guys have settled into their jobs very, very well. A slight change in responsibilities has occurred through that restructure. Mark is now responsible for all things revenue, television, interactivity, online, and mobile.
Well, it's worth spelling that out, actually, because the shorthand I sometimes use to describe MCN, and I know this is kind of slightly incorrect, will be the sales house of pay TV. Now, clearly, you don't do all of the pay TV channels, and you do a bit more than just pay TV. And also, I know that people hate me saying pay TV rather than subscription TV as well. But actually, how would you describe the remit of MCN?
The reason that we call ourselves the multi-channel network is that our remit is much greater than just selling 30-second advertising spots on subscription television. We're increasingly looking at all of the audio-visual channels to market. So we sell television directly, as you know, it's still clearly our core business. But by extension from that, we also sell interactive advertising, both iAds through the red button, long-form content through the green button bookable advertising model, plus our on-demand advertising model. We also represent Foxtel by mobile, and of course we're increasingly selling advertising on mobile websites. Plus we look after all of the online interests of the channels that we represent, plus a whole range of independent websites. And we are increasingly looking at new business models in the future that will extend our remit further into other audio-visual advertising opportunities that aren't traditionally television-based.
And I've always been slightly unclear on the ownership structure. You're owned directly by Foxtel, is that how it works?
Or? We have four shareholders, Foxtel, Austar, that may change in the in the not-too-distant future, XYZ Networks, and Premier Media Group are the four shareholders of MCN.
Premier Media Group, the people behind sort of Fox Sports.
Fox Sports, yes, that's correct.
Yeah, okay. And what's your sense on what the market is doing?
The market overall is it's a bit unpredictable. It's certainly shorter than was the case 12 months ago. And we're seeing some fluctuations by month and by quarter. But I think the most important thing to note in relation to this is over the last 12 months, what we saw was after one of the largest downturns in, you know, economic activity since the Great Depression, and one of the greatest downturns in recent history in advertising, we saw a recovery that took place across effectively three quarters. So we saw a 5 or 6 quarter downturn recover in less than 4 quarters. So as a consequence, we saw massive growth in a number of those quarters. So the year-on-year comparisons look a little worse than we would like,
yes.
But the long-term trend line is actually not so bad.
How exposed are you to retail? Because this sort of exploding issue over the last 2 or 3 weeks seems to be a sudden fall in consumer confidence.
We are, I guess, as exposed to retail as the free-to-air networks are, as the broader television market is. Retail is one of the biggest advertising categories.
And do you share this sudden pessimism? It surprised me how quickly this slightly pessimistic mood seems to have come.
Yes, I think that the retail market is very, very challenged. There is no question of that. You only have to look at the results of the major retailers at the moment. And there are budgetary pressures on the retailers, but at the moment they are, largely speaking, continuing to spend. They can't just lay down and accept that the world is difficult and challenged and not try to stimulate demand. So they're continuing to spend. They will continue to spend. It may not be at the sort of growth rates we might like, but I don't think it's the end of the world for retail, far from it. So there is definitely an impact. The impact on us being MCN is less than a lot of other media companies are seeing, because we're still in a growth phase overall. So we're able to work around that.
Are you finding that areas that are struggling are perhaps looking at using, you know, your services and advertising away from a traditional 30-second ad? They're thinking, okay, that might not have worked for us. Why don't we try something different?
We do a lot of different things at MCN. One of the things we believe in is everything we do is built on the idea of innovation and new advertising models and new creative strategic campaigns for clients. So we've been doing that for a long, long time. As we mentioned, you know, we house all of our media divisions under the one roof, and that allows us to be very innovative in our approach. So advertisers are increasingly looking for that, and we create many of those sorts of campaigns for all of our advertisers, retail, FMCG, auto, finance, using all of the assets that we have available to us.
Now, I remember getting sort of quite excited when I was at Media Week in the UK about talking about the red button and how this was going to be one of the things that would revolutionise advertising. At the time, there was a chap called Rob Leach was selling it over there. And then I came here, and again, there was a chap called Rob Leach was talking about it over here. I mean, my sense is that, you know, there have been a few sort of okay things with the red button, but maybe it's ending up as a little bit of a kind of rounding error on the end of other things rather than a, you know, something that's kind of changed the game. Is that a fair observation, that maybe it's not as big as we all thought it was going to be?
We never believed, based on the learnings that we had from the UK in particular, we were never anticipating that interactive advertising was going to be a game changer. It is a wonderful addition to any campaign for any advertiser that is trying to generate a deeper connection with a potential consumer rather than just trying to reach an audience. And to this day, red button advertising in Australia is still very, very performing very well, and it's in high demand. We look at the moment like we're going to be sold out of all opportunities for August, which will be really terrific for us because we've built a whole new automated system and we have much greater capacity than we've had in the past, and we've pretty much sold out those opportunities. So red button advertising is still working very well. Many of our advertisers, particularly in the auto category, and Toyota is the client that tends to lead the charge in this space, have a red button application on every retail campaign because they get real leads from real consumers, and it works very well for them. We're running a range of long format campaigns through interactivity at the moment, through bookable advertising and on demand, and all of them are performing exceptionally well because, of course, today we're in a position where we can measure the degree of interactivity through our back channel ratings panel, MultiView. So that's raised it to a whole nother level now because these campaigns are now fully accountable.
How much data are you pulling out of MultiView? And maybe explain what it is for people.
More than
you
can imagine. It's a 10,000 home panel measuring Foxtel and Austar homes nationally. And it's real live daily data out of the back of the Foxtel set-top box or the Austar set-top box. So what we're able to do is capture every press of every button on the remote control. What we've also done to further strengthen that, that richness of information is asked all of our homes a series of questions, which we update regularly, so that we can have a much deeper understanding of information that goes beyond standard demographics, all sorts of segmentation information around income, propensity to purchase, when you're likely to travel next, how much you're likely to spend on your next car and when. And the richness of information is unbelievable. So we now know more about our audience than pretty much any other media company in the country.
And when you look at the patterns of sort of viewing behaviour, do they match what Oztam is telling you as well?
Broadly speaking, they do. What we see, which is valuable for us, is a little less bounce in the numbers because the panel is significantly bigger. A 10,000 home panel is about eight times larger than the number of homes that Oztam measure for subscription television.
And Oztam also mentions obviously free to air as well.
Of course. So you know we've never set this up as being an industry wide currency. It's not. Hasn't been set up in competition with Oztam. We use it to complement the main industry currency by allowing us to understand a lot more about our audience, about the potential consumer, which is what advertisers are screaming out for all around the world, and also, importantly, to measure all of the interactivity.
Okay. Let's talk about programming. Which are the big shows coming up in the season that are going to give you commercial opportunities around?
We've had a few already, and we've got many more to come. There's been some wonderful results for us so far this year. Just recently, we had the final of the Super Rugby that delivered nearly 520,000 average audience, which is an all-time ratings record for subscription television, not just in sport but across the board. So that was a fabulous outcome. The rugby union this year, the Super Rugby with the revised format, we've seen growth of... I haven't got the final number, but it'll be 20 to 30% growth year on year, which is fantastic.
And, of course, those numbers won't count the number of people who are watching it in a pub somewhere as well.
Oh, of course. Yeah, the out-of-home number is enormous, and it's something we're actually looking at updating at the moment is to get a much better sense of what's happening out-of-home to further bolster those numbers. The NRL is up very strong double digits. The AFL is in the same boat, so sport is doing particularly well for us this year. Movies are up across the board. Project Runway Australia just launched on Arena with 30% improvement in ratings year on year. We've got Australia's Next Top Model Series 7 launching shortly.
And when does that? Have you said when that is launching yet? Have you announced the?
Was it August 9? Was it?
You're going to test my memory. on well, August 8th. Well done.
Close.
well spotted. So August 8th, and we've got all six major sponsors back on board with record revenue against that show, which is fantastic.
And this is with a new production company this year,
That's
I think.
Correct, yes.
What's obviously, last year we saw the bit of the hiccup with the final announcement there.
It's worth, for people who don't remember,
Sarah Murdoch was the host at the time, and I believe she is back again this season.
That's right, yes.
There was a bit of a technical glitch. Whoever's fault it was in the end, I can't remember, but the wrong winner was announced. Plans for the final show, is it going to be not recorded or not live this time?
I'm not going to release the plans
right.
For the final
It was worth
show,
a try.
Of course. But rest assured that the producers will put all of the stopgap requirements in place to ensure that no error occurs this year.
Sure.
These things happen with live television.
Yep.
It became one of the most talked about TV shows of the year,
that
which otherwise it wouldn't have done. Yeah.
Global exposure. It was terrific. So look, there's a lot of good content coming up. Sky News at the moment, so far this year, its audience is up over 20%. Lots of major events and things happening. So, you know, for us, we've got Deadliest Catch, the new series coming up on Discovery. The list goes on. We put to air MCN alone, over 15,000 hours of content a week. We've got more new content on the platform than ever before, more Australian-produced content, more exclusive content. So we think the balance of the year for us is pretty good. You know, MCN's audience so far this year is up 10%. So we're pretty happy with how things are tracking.
Well, next, tussling over TV stats.
To advertise with one of the top 10 most loved brands in Australia, visit advertise.ebay.com.au.
This week, Freeview CEO Robin Parks somewhat provocatively suggested there is no need for pay TV after releasing analysis of the audience. They say that the secondary channel share, so you've got 7.2, 7.8, Go, Gem, 11, 1, ABC2, ABC News 24 and SBS2 has grown to 19.53% over the last 6 months, with subscription channel share at 16.14%. Now, free TV rating shares are primarily based on five city metro audiences from 6pm to midnight. MCM had their own analysis of the data, arguing that when viewing is measured from 6am to midnight, pay TV wins the share in the 16 to 54 demographic, which is 5.4% up year on year. Anthony, are you guys ever going to, you know, sort it out and measure it all together?
It'd be nice to see one metric everyone would agree with.
Yeah, look, I've been very clear on this for 8 years, since joining MCN from free-to-air television. Every network puts out a different spin every week, it seems, with different time zones and different demographic profiles. And I have no issue with that whatsoever. Every network must look at their greatest strengths and where they're performing well and where they're targeting their performance and sell it aggressively, no question. What I've been calling for, and I called for again recently, is a standard industry measure that everybody reports on, all journalists report on, that that provides a broad industry measure to measure performance over the longer term. And then all of the other sales spin below that should absolutely occur based on individual programs and individual channels and overall performance against different demographics. But the fact is that, you know, over 90%, around 95% of all revenue is generated within the 16 to 54 age group and the demographic subsets of that. Nobody in the industry buys all people. No one buys homes. Homes don't ever go to the shop and buy something. People do. And no one buys all people. So 16 to 54 is a broad demographic, I think, makes sense. I'm also, you know, comfortable with total people as a measure. And the reason that we believe 0600 to 2400 is the right broad measure is because about $1 billion out of the total television pie is spent in off-peak. And I've said before that if the free-to-air networks have no interest in that $1 billion, then I'll take it off their hands, no problem. It's not just about prime time, although prime time is the driver. I accept that. So there should be a simple measure, which is overall 06 to 2400 and prime time against one core demographic that measures broad performance. That's all I've been arguing. The rest of the debate, whilst interesting, is pretty shallow. You know, free TV came out and said that you no longer need pay TV because the digital channels outrate all of pay TV. Absolutely meaningless. Absolutely meaningless. 3 years ago, there were no digital channels. And the major channels, the 7, 9 and 10 main channels, captured 70% of viewing. Today, 7, 9 and 10 and the digital channels capture, guess what, 70% of viewing. It is a meaningless debate to say that the digital channels mean you don't need to use pay TV anymore. In fact, a good example of that is that 90% of all viewing to the digital channels has come from the main channels. They once were capturing 71% of viewing, the 7, 9 and 10 channels. They're now capturing about 51% of viewing. The other 20 points has moved to the digital channels. So they've cannibalized their own audience to such a degree that they're now looking to find ways to utilise the performance of the digital channels against subscription television. And the facts remain that it's a meaningless debate. Total television is doing very well. Total television audiences are up, and that's the main story.
And, you know, I'm reading your talking points upside down in front of you, and the first one is TV is in great shape. That's the key message.
It is. It's the key message from me and has been for quite some time. I mean, we will vigorously fight for our share of revenue, we'll vigorously fight for our share of voice in the market. But the fact is, television is in terrific shape. There's been a flight back to television from advertisers. Television viewing is up globally. Television advertising, I believe, is more impactful than ever. We've got these wonderful big HD screens sitting on our walls at home. Television's in terrific shape. It's more relevant than ever before. And the choice that is now being offered, even by the free-to-air networks, is bringing people back to television. It's fantastic.
Do you see the secondary channels must be some sort of threat? You know, I speak as, you know, I've subscribed to Foxtel the whole time I've been in the country, and I've noticed that my consumption habits have changed a bit in recent months. You know, I'm you know, through my Foxtel box, I'm watching the secondary channels, where presumably before I would have been watching a Foxtel channel at times. So I'm sure there has been a shift.
Well, the question's often asked of me, have the digital channels had an impact on your business? If I say no, that wouldn't be true, because they have captured some audience. But the real fact is it's immaterial. The total share of viewing in subscription television homes for the digital channels is about 4%. 4%. To put that in perspective for you guys and for the listening audience, remember this simple fact. In subscription television homes, those people with Foxtel, Fox 8 alone generates more audience than all six digital channels combined. Because in Foxtel homes, very few people are watching those channels.
Well, next, Australia's most trusted brands and dirty grannies.
You're listening to the Mumbrella Cast. For more on all of these stories, visit mumbrella.com.au. Reader's Digest has released a fairly unsexy ranking of Australia's most trusted brands, with Colgate, Dettol, Cadbury, Panadol and Band-Aid voted as the top five. Brands are also ranked by category. Out of the banks, none of the big ones managed to rank particularly well, with Bendigo Bank the most trusted and St George and ING highly commended. Alice, your take first on the rankings.
It's interesting to see, other than Cadbury, all of those brands are health related. So, you know, keeping yourself either clean or healthy. So obviously that trust in brands is associated to, I want to make myself good. Interestingly though, they were categorised, the best brands were also categorised, and even the best fast food brand was Subway. So another example of people, even in fast food, obviously there's a trend to keeping healthy and staying clean, apart from if you like Cadbury chocolate, I guess.
And it felt like a very middle
Australia.
Well, that's true. It felt like a very middle Australia list as well. I thought, how do you go about making consumers trust your brand? Where do you start?
Can I just go back a step? Because I missed your intro slightly, I think. Did you say that this is the sexiest brand?
The unsexiest in our views, yes. Yes, that was me editorialising slightly.
Right,
yes.
Well, definitely a bunch of unsexy brands, except for perhaps Cadbury. But clearly very trusted brands and brands that people rely on. Look, brand building is, you know, a challenge for any advertiser, I guess. And increasingly today, with the massive choice that we have available to us in every brand category, including television for that matter, then brands become increasingly important. And, you know, brand building comes down to these days a whole range of things, from clearly above the line advertising all the way, you know, through the line, to deliver that degree of trust
and
to ensure that people become loyal to your brand. It's more critical today than ever before.
And do you think some of it's just consistency, doing it year after year after year?
I think absolutely it's consistency. You know, if you look at some of the best brands in the world outside of these brands, such as Nike, Coca-Cola, Toyota, you know, these brands have often kept the same positioning and the same strap line and the same look for decades, to deliver on that consistent message and that trusted message and developing that belief in quality over the longer term.
Well, we're on the topic of brands. Brewer Matilda Bay has launched a new brand of cider called Dirty Granny. Anthony, what are you seeing happening in the alcohol category? You know, we're noticing that we've seen a couple of cider launches recently. What's going on?
Well, there's definitely been a shift in the alcohol category. It's becoming increasingly challenged for the beer category in particular on two key levels. One, beer consumption is down as the Australian population is starting to, explore other products.
Well, we've seen Booney promoting Canadian Club this week.
The world-famous VB drinker.
Absolutely,
promoting
yes.
a spirit.
And then, of course, the other question around that, which sort of came up when we were covering it, is someone who sort of became associated with binge drinking, I suppose.
Yes.
Is it a good look for an alcohol brand for him to still be the face of it in 2011?
Possibly not, but Booney is, you know, widely loved and recognised. I mean, there's always a bit of a challenge using high-profile talent in advertising of any kind. But I don't know that Booney will revert back to his binge drinking days. One would hope not at this point in his life. But the alcohol category is expanding rapidly, and many of those advertisers, of course, are turning to television to get their brands into the market, which is sort of offsetting some of the decline in the beer category. But beer is also challenged because there's such a wide diversity of choice. But then that applies to wine and spirits and everything these days.
And Alice, going back to Dirty Granny, interesting sort of PR strategy behind it as well.
Yeah, they're doing a various crocheting championships. So I think one's
extreme
underwater.
Crochet, yeah.
I think one's underwater and is one in while skiing or something. I can't quite remember what the others are. But yeah, they're tying that in there to get the brand out there. And the actual logo is a crocheted looking piece of material.
Well, Ali, our colleague Robin, who's not in the podcast today, has been wearing his crocheted Dirty Granny hat all week since that particular piece of free publicity arrived in the office. I think it's Liquid Ideas is the PR agency.
Yeah, yeah.
Friend of the podcast, Stuart Greger, behind Liquid Ideas. Well, next, the Murdochs face the music.
Are you spending where they're spending? Visit advertise.ebay.com.au.
As most Australians rested their heads on Wednesday night, News Corp's Rupert and James Murdoch and Rebecca Brooks faced a panel of British MPs to discuss the News of the World phone hacking saga. Let's have a listen to what they had to say about their knowledge of the scandal.
Mr. Murdoch, at what point did you find out that criminality was endemic at News of the World?
Endemic is a very hard... It's a very wide-ranging word. And I also had to be extremely careful not to prejudice the course of justice which is taking place now. That has been disclosed, I became aware as it became apparent. The first two, and then I was absolutely shocked, appalled, and ashamed when I heard about the Millie Dowler case only 2 weeks ago, eight days before I saw them.
We saw the story at the same time that you all saw the story. My instant reaction, like everybody else, was one of shock and disgust that a family who had suffered so much already had that these allegations that were clearly added immeasurably to their suffering. The first thing I did was write to Mr. and Mrs. Dowler with a full apology to say that we would get to the bottom of the allegations, and if anyone, either representing the News of the World or authorised by a professional journalist at the News of the World, which I still find staggering to believe, but if we find out that is true, and I have every confidence that News International and the police will get to the bottom of that, and they should as a priority. After 2007, there was committee hearings. News International conducted the internal investigation that you covered extensively in the previous session, and the police closed the inquiry. And from my own knowledge, in 2006, because my own phone, as everyone knows now, was accessed by Glenmore Care, my own voicemail, sorry, were accessed by Glenmore Care on a regular basis, I had the same knowledge that everyone else was, and whether you can say it's a myth now, clearly we have now seen evidence that that is not the case. But it wasn't a myth, it was what everyone believed at the time. I can't comment on what others knew and when they knew it and how they knew it. I can only tell this committee what I knew while I was editor of the News of the World and subsequently editor of The Sun. And as chief executive, I can account for my actions in trying to get to the bottom of this story. And in 2006, from my own personal point of view, I was the editor of The Sun. I have been approached by the police to explain the nature of acts.
Tim, you were up in the middle of the night watching it all unfold. Are you surprised with their reactions, or I guess lack thereof?
Yeah, I suppose firstly, it was so hyped beforehand. This was going to be the big confrontation, the sort of the calling to account. It was a huge day. There were at one of the other parliamentary committees, a couple of the key police involved had spoken as well. But obviously, people wanted to speak to the MPs. Wanted to speak to Rebecca Brooks, who, as Rebecca Wade, as she had been previously, had been the editor of the News of the World and then later became the chief executive of News International and had just resigned and then been arrested. So there was a lot going on, a lot to talk about. At the same time, you'd had for the end of the kind of the period, kind of the aftermath of the phone hacking, James Murdoch had been running News International. He'd been there locally as well, so there were questions for him, and of course Rupert Murdoch as global CEO and global chairman of News Corp, the parent company. But I think we were expecting a key moment where they would suddenly admit everything or something like that. That was almost how the hype was.
Yeah, and I guess the most exciting climax was when Rupert's wife Wendy Deng, approached the guy that was about to throw a cream pie into Rupert's face, which I thought I kind of liked, well, for comedy value, but also because it showed a human element. They were so polished, and Rupert can be held in some kind of subhuman class, that to see his wife defend him, I thought was...
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing, because it had come across that James Murdoch came across as very polished. Rupert Murdoch came across as much vaguer, I thought,
yeah.
Actually. I found myself... I'd probably take issue with the description subhuman, actually. I found myself actually feeling sort of sympathetic to him on there on the stand being asked questions he really didn't know the answer to, as an 80-year-old guy.
Sure.
That was what was coming across.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I must admit, for me, I'd sort of... By this point, it had been going on for about 2.5 hours, so it's about 2 a.m. Eastern time. So I decided I was going to go and listen to the rest, having watched it on Sky News or one of the channels, the TV channels at the point. I'd just gone to bed to listen to the rest on ABC News Radio, who, for reasons best known to themselves, thought this was a great moment just to come back and have a bit of a chat in the studio about what's gone on. And that was almost instantly when the attack on Rupert Murdoch took place. And of course, they were in confusion, because what happens with these parliamentary committees is they've got strict rules about what the cameras can show of proceedings, because it's relatively recently cameras are allowed in at all. So if there's any sort of disturbance, the camera has to cut away so as not to encourage demonstrations and stuff. So you just glimpsed in the corner of the screen what had happened.
Yeah.
So, of course, the ABC were completely lost because their person had been talking and didn't know. So it was literally, oh, something's happened. Oh, it stopped. I don't know. So I found myself wide awake again, back in front of the television, then actually writing a story about it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, yes, it was followed by the hearing with Rebecca Brooks, who, to her credit, bearing in mind she had been arrested a few days before, so clearly, legal proceedings were potentially active, could have chosen to say much less than she did.
Sure.
Nobody admitted to anything they, hadn't previously admitted, but they at least kind of, I suppose, showed contrition and, attempted to give their picture of it. I think you're right. The Wendy Deng moment was the human moment,
because she was
always in shot of sitting just behind sort of Rupert Murdoch and, occasionally sort of, tapping him on the shoulder or whatever. There's lots of coverage since suggesting that she did far more for the PR around it than the hefty retainer Edelman have got.
Yeah, well, there you go. But Rupert's flown back to the States. How do you think, How much involvement do you think he's going to have in the hearings? Is it going to be more about Andy Coulson and Rebecca Brooks? What do you see happening from his point of view?
Yeah, I mean, we're still at the point where every morning when we wake up here in Australia, things have moved on again. So last night there was an emergency sitting at the Commons in which the Prime Minister came under, David Cameron came under more pressure again over his connections with Andy Coulson, who had been the former News of the World editor and then worked as a media advisor to the Prime Minister, and suggestions that some of the compromise involving the police was because of that. So there were all of those, and there's been the strong signal that the public inquiry, which, you know, headed up by a judge with power to compel witnesses to come along, which will probably go on for weeks or months, but, you know, has full judicial weight, that's going to start very quickly. And that's a new piece that has come in this week, whereas previously, I think most people had thought it would happen after any kind of legal cases. So it will go on for ages yet.
Sure. Closer to home, John Hartigan released a statement on, I think it was Wednesday afternoon, to his staff in defence to Julia Gillard's comments about looking further into News Limited.
Yes, yeah, so John Hartigan, CEO and chairman of News Limited here in Australia, which is the local offshoot of News Corp. Now, this followed sort of relatively opportunistic comments from Julia Gillard, sort of saying, well, you know, News Limited might have questions to answer here too. I don't think she had any evidence of any kind of wrongdoing, and that was the kind of the point from John Hartigan. It is, you know, it's kind of unfair to be drawing a link between the two. Mm-hmm. And what we've also seen this week is the sort of probably the opportunistic thing from the politicians of trying to create some sort of privacy law here in Australia while people's moods are on this subject, which, you know, to me, my instant reaction is, I'm sure it might be popular, but it could be disastrous for freedom of speech. You know, without some sort of enshrined right to freedom of speech, which doesn't specifically exist in Australian law, I find the idea of privacy law quite scary.
Mm, it's going to be an interesting one, quite technical between those two areas to keep it going. But
yeah, okay. I think so. We'll have to see. I mean, there's a lot yet to come. There's plenty of twists and turns in the UK and here in Australia. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks very much to MCN's Anthony Fitzgerald.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Alice.
And to Mumbrella's Alice Terlikovsky.
Thanks, guys.
The Mumbrella cast was recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Toodle-pip.